The first signaling mechanism that I wish to review for you are those that involve intracellular receptors. Intracellular receptors, of course, are the targets for a number of hormones. I'm thinking of glucocorticoids, I'm thinking of aldosterone, the sex hormones, thyroid hormone interacts with intracellular receptors, etc. The binding of these hormones happens to bring about the release of various regulatory proteins. For example, binding of glucocorticoid to receptors in cells can displace various proteins that have heat sensitivity. And this then allows for dimerization of the hormone receptor complex and the ability of the complex to cross the nuclear membrane and interact with response elements on nucleic acid, which can change gene expression and thus change protein synthesis by that mechanism. By way of illustration, let me remind you that most of the time we use glucocorticoids in medicine, it is not for hormonal purposes in terms of replacement therapy, but it's because these drugs are very effective anti-inflammatory and immunosuppressant agents. So, for example, if we use dexamethasone as an anti-inflammatory agent, it's probably going to work just like hydrocortisone would have worked as a glucocorticoid, going through the steps that we've just described and changing protein synthesis, leading, for example, to the synthesis of a protein that can interfere with the enzyme phospholipase 2. Now, what does phospholipase A2 do? It's the enzyme that releases arachidonic acid from cell membranes. And arachidonic acid is the precursor of leukotrienes. Leukotrienes are very inflammatory mediators. And therefore, if you can interfere with their synthesis, you have a very effective anti-inflammatory action. So I like you to think of these hormone receptors as also being drug receptors, because as I say, most of the time you use glucocorticoids, it's for their drug action. Likewise, most of the time we use gonadosteroids. I mean, what's the most of the time we're going to use an estrogen? It's not for specifically only for replacement therapy in menopause. A lot of the use of estrogens, of course, is as contraceptive agents. Once again, you're interacting with receptors, you're changing, obviously, gene expression and the synthesis of proteins. And this is a sort of mechanistic action that's relevant to pharmacology. As a rule, when you modify the gene expression leading to protein synthesis, you have slow responses. They may take hours and sometimes days before they peak. And you usually have a relatively protracted duration of action that is commensurate with the life of the protein that has been synthesized. Now, in contrast to that type of signaling mechanism, we have some signaling mechanisms where the receptors are directly coupled to ion channels. These are particularly important in, for example, neurons. The nicotinic receptor, for example, in the sympathetic ganglia and the parasympathetic ganglia is responsible for transmission of all autonomic messages. And it's the actual target, if you like, for nicotine itself and for drugs that can activate such types of acetylcholine receptor and block that receptor. Likewise, nicotine receptors are at the skeletal muscle junction. So every physical movement we make in terms of our skeletal muscle involves activation of a nicotinic receptor. Well, what does a nicotinic receptor look like? Well, actually, it looks like a receptor that can identify acetylcholine and other types of chemical related to nicotine, but also is an ion channel. And the ion channel in this context is for sodium and to some extent potassium, allowing sodium to run down its concentration gradient. So every muscle move we make involves sodium running down its concentration gradient, bringing about a depolarization at a skeletal muscle end plate. So you can see how obviously this relates to pharmacology. Similarly, GABA receptors are coupled to ion channels. One type of GABA receptor, GABA is, of course, gamma-aminobutyric acid, present in the brain, is very important in the context of anti-anxiety and anti-epileptic drugs. This is the GABA-A receptor that is coupled directly to a chloride ion channel. Now, remember that when sodium runs down its gradient, you depolarize a membrane. When chloride runs down its gradient in the same direction from the outside to the inside, you don't depolarize, you do the opposite. You hyperpolarize the membrane. And hyperpolarization is inhibitory. So GABA is one of our important inhibitory transmitters in the central nervous system and a target for many benzodiazepines and many anticonvulsant drugs and some hypnotic drugs, sleeping pills, etc. So this obviously are very important signaling mechanisms that are relevant to pharmacological action. It doesn't restrict our thinking only to GABA or to nicotinic receptors. There are a number of other systems that also use ion channels directly coupled to the receptor. And by directly coupled, what we're referring to is no other biochemistry is needed in the response. You don't need to go through phosphorylation to get the response, put it that way. These responses are rapid. They may occur over the duration of a few milliseconds, and they're usually quite short in duration. Now, when I say direct coupling, I'm using that in contrast to receptor systems that might also involve ion channels, but are not directly coupled, but are linked via coupling proteins to enzymes. The classic example of that is, of course, those receptors that are linked to adenyl cyclase by GTP binding proteins. The receptors here usually are of the serpentine type. They look like a snake, and they have seven transmembrane spanning domains. One of the domains on the outside of the cell recognizes the drug, the hormone, the transmitter, and the third loop going into the cell happens to be that which is coupled via a G protein to either activation of or inhibition of cyclic AMP. Now, what does cyclic AMP do? It activates protein kinase A, and this in turn leads to phosphorylation of multiple types of proteins which are tissue specific. And thus, the responses that we see depend on the tissue and depend on the nature of the proteins that are phosphorylated. We have two types of G protein family linked to adenyl cyclase, GS and GI. GS, S for stimulation, is coupled in terms of receptors to catecholamines that activate beta receptors. For many years, we thought that cyclic AMP was the most important and perhaps the only real, well-identified, quote, second messenger substance. A second messenger being, you know, the messenger that is downstream from the first messenger, which could be acetylcholine or norepinephrine or what have you. So this was a second messenger compound. About a decade ago or so, people identified another type of mechanism where we use GTP binding proteins, but they don't have coupling to adenyl cyclase. Instead, they have coupling to an enzyme present in cell membranes called phospholipase C. Now, these types of G protein, to distinguish them from GS and GI, which modify adenyl cyclase, are referred to generally as a family as GQ proteins. When we have activation of receptors linked to GQ proteins, we actually activate phospholipase C, which is an enzyme that can hydrolyze a phospholipid present in cell membranes. The name of that phospholipid is phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate, usually abbreviated as PIP2. And from this phosphate, two second messengers are released. One is called inositol triphosphate, or IP3, and the other is called diacylglycerol, or DAG. IP3 releases calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum in the cell, and together with diacylglycerol, activates protein kinase C. Not phospholipase C here, don't get confused, right? Protein kinase C. This in turn results in phosphorylation of specific proteins in tissues and obviously ultimately leads to pharmacological responses. Well, what receptors are of interest to us here when it comes to drugs? Quite a few. Acetylcholine receptors that are not in the heart, but in other tissues in our body, for example, those in our salivary glands that make saliva, etc., those in our GI tract, those that are present at other tissues other than the heart, happen to be linked via GQ proteins to the activation of phospholipase C. And many of the drugs that we use, such as, for example, atropine to dry up my oral secretions, which I could use it for, would be working through this messenger system. Norepinephrine is a transmitter at sympathetic nerve terminals that actually are innervating vascular smooth muscle. Alpha-1 receptors are involved there, and this is a GQ-linked system. So, what happens when norepinephrine interacts with this receptor? You get vasoconstriction. Is that of any use to us clinically? You bet. You bet it is. When every time you use a decongestant and you drop something into your nose, why are you getting decongestion? Because you brought about a vasoconstriction. What did you do? You used a drug that activated an alpha-1 receptor. What did that do? That stimulated phospholipase C. What did that do? It released diacylglycerol and IP3, and you phosphorylated a few proteins, and the next thing you knew was you had vasoconstriction. Ah, you can breathe again. And that's a mechanism of action that is very, very well described. Angiotensin II. A bad actor when it comes to hypertension in patients, right? Part of the time, what we want to do is try and prevent formation of angiotensin II. Why? Because one of the actions of angiotensin II is to increase the release of the mineralocorticoid aldosterone. And what's that going to do? Well, downstream, that's going to cause water and sodium retention. It's going to increase blood volume, and it's going to increase blood pressure. So angiotensin II, when we use drugs that are called ACE inhibitors, what are they going to do? They're going to inhibit ultimately angiotensin II formation and therefore interfere with this GQ protein linked system that involves hydrolysis through phospholipase C. So these are the features, I think, that you need to know about those coupling proteins. So we like to see both adenyl cyclase and phospholipase C represented in a single diagram. And the diagram shows us that we can either activate adenyl cyclase, for example, by beta-1 receptor activity, increasing the formation of cyclic AMP, or we could actually inhibit the formation of adenyl cyclase through a GI protein, as we do when acetylcholine activates a muscarinic receptor in the heart. We can see in the diagram that activation of an alpha-1 receptor at the blood vessel level activates a phospholipase that will release inositol triphosphate and diacylglycerol. This is a GQ protein-linked system. So the diagram puts it all together and I think would be a good summary diagram for you in reviewing your messenger systems or your effector systems that are modified by drugs that use second messengers. Now, there is one aspect of a second messenger that is specific, really, to us in pharmacology that has to be talked about separately from, say, cyclic AMP or IP3 or DAG, and that is cyclic GMP. Cyclic GMP is important for us in appreciating the role of nitric oxide as a signaling mechanism in vascular smooth muscle. Cyclic GMP is a second messenger, just like cyclic AMP, I suppose, and its action in the vasculature is to stimulate the loss of a phosphate group from myosin light chains. It actually activates enzymes that bring about dephosphorylation. Now, myosin light chains, normally when they're phosphorylated, can bind to actin, the other contractile protein, and it's the phosphorylated form that can bind such that you can bring about an event leading to contraction of the smooth muscle. Now, if you've dephosphorylated myosin light chains, then the myosin light chains in the non-phosphorylated or dephosphorylated form can't interact with actin. If it can't interact with actin, you can't get a contraction of the smooth muscle. And if you can't get a contraction of the smooth muscle, you can't constrict. And if you can't constrict, what do? You vasodilate. So cyclic GMP brings about vasodilation. Where does nitric oxide come in then? Well, nitric oxide is a natural endogenous compound, that's for sure. For example, it's present in endothelial cells that line the blood vessels, and presumably when you activate certain receptors that can release nitric oxide, the nitric oxide can bring about this vasodilation through the steps that we just described. What can release nitric oxide? Well, activation of muscarinic receptors can do it. That's one possibility. But you know, one compound that does it very, very easily is histamine. When you're stung by a bee, right, you're going to release histamine from mast cells. You're going to lower blood pressure. Why are you going to lower blood pressure? You're going to lower blood pressure because that histamine is going to release nitric oxide via its interaction with H1 receptors on the endothelial cell. And that nitric oxide is going to bring about a vasodilation. No wonder your blood pressure drops down when you've been hit by a bee in terms of the venom releasing the release of histamine. It goes through this mechanism of nitric oxide. We also use many drugs that can actually break down to form nitric oxide. Nitroprusside, nitroglycerine, isosorbide dinitrate. All of these drugs are very good vasodilators. Why are they good vasodilators? Because they release nitric oxide from their chemical structure, and nitric oxide then activates guanyl cyclase. And what does guanyl cyclase do? Guanyl cyclase forms cyclic GMP. And what does cyclic GMP do? It causes dephosphorylation of myosin light chains, and that means you can't get a contraction. So you can see that in this slide here, I'm emphasizing this very strongly as a mechanism distinctive from cyclic AMP. This is cyclic GMP, and it's a very important from the standpoint of pharmacology. Now, when I first started in pharmacology, we had a couple of drugs that worked as enzyme inhibitors. We had cholinesterase inhibitors, for example, and we had inhibitors of carbonic anhydrase. As time has gone by, of course, we have multiple drug actions that are thought to be exerted at the level of inhibition of enzyme activity. The more we find out about the enzymes and how they may be important in cellular functioning, the more we find out drugs that can modify that cellular functioning. In the sense of the importance of knowing every individual one of these enzymes that can be inhibited by drugs, I don't think that's the critical issue at this particular stage. But I thought it would be of interest to give you at least a selection of different drugs that are important regarding their ability to inhibit various enzymes in our body. And let me just illustrate that for you. There are many drugs that are inhibitors of acetylcholinesterase, and these have multiple uses ranging from myasthenia to glaucoma, the management of glaucoma. That's a very high-yield enzyme as examinations go, let me tell you. Acetylcholinesterase is an enzyme that I look at as a keeper for preparation for exams. Angiotensin-converting enzyme, the so-called ACE. Well, ACE inhibitors are all over the place. We must have a dozen now ACE inhibitors that are in medicine. What for? What are they used for? They're used for hypertension. I don't know how many millions of our patients in the North America are actually using ACE inhibitors, but it must be many, many millions. Aspartate protease. Oh, I like that one. You know the PIs that are used in the management of patients who have HIV? These are aspartate protease inhibitors. So protease inhibitors, or PIs, are working by preventing the formation of a protein from a precursor molecule and are active against human immunodeficiency virus. Dihydrofolate reductase, an example, methotrexate. anti-cancer drug and a drug widely used in rheumatoid arthritis. How does it work? It interferes with the synthesis of tetrahydrofolic acid, a very important coenzyme in the production of purines and of certain proteins in terms of methionine. DNA and RNA polymerases. So many drugs work on these enzymes. Antiviral drugs work there. Acyclovir is a good example, used in herpes. You know, all sorts of drugs work there. This is an illustration, as it were, for you of some of the enzymes that are critical to you in trying to identify how drugs work. And some of them concern our own enzymes. Many of them concern enzymes present in infecting organisms like viruses, bacteria, etc. And you can see it's a huge area of pharmacology. What about drugs that work on transporter molecules? We have drugs that can influence the uptake of dopamine, GABA, norepinephrine, and serotonin. Perhaps just by illustration, I'll give you one little subgroup there just to show you the extent of the interest here. The drug Prozac, fluoxetine. Fluoxetine was the parent drug of a family of drugs now that we call SSRIs. And what does that stand for? Serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors. Serotonin being, of course, 5-HT or 5-hydroxytryptamine. And how many drugs are out there now? 6, I think it is, that are all used, you know, very importantly for various psychiatric and emotional conditions, right, including major depressive disorder, but not restricted to that indication. So if you wanted an example of drugs working by influencing transporters, that would be a very good example for you. Now, lately we've been seeing things in terms of transmembrane functioning enzymes. We've known for a long time that insulin, and you can call that a drug if you want to, but we've known for a long time that insulin interacts with a receptor that can span the membrane. The outside of the cell recognizes insulin, and when insulin binds to it, the receptor dimerizes and increases the activity of a tyrosine kinase, which is the sort of back end of the receptor, but this one is inside the cell. And that tyrosine kinase leads to phosphorylation of proteins. Now, we also know now that many other systems do use that, including epidermal growth factor, EGF. Atrial natriuretic factor, ANF. A number of things other than insulin work in a very similar mechanism to insulin. Now, the reason that we want you to know about insulin, of course, is that sort of everybody wants you to know about insulin, really, don't they? Biochemists do, pathologists do. Well, you know, insulin in the sense of the management of type 1 diabetes is a drug, and so we certainly need you to know that much about it in terms of a mechanism of action. What about other systems that, I've already mentioned this aspect of where we see a dimerization and an activation of tyrosine kinases. What about some of the newer drugs that are coming into medicine that we used to identify in the past as sort of biochemical entities that were just out there? We called them cytokines or sometimes lymphokines when they affected lymphocyte function. The receptors for big molecules like erythropoietin, growth hormone, alpha, beta, and gamma interferons. How do they work? What are they doing in terms of signaling mechanism? The receptors that for these molecules are again membrane spanning and again can affect kinase activity. But they are not actually one molecule that has both the role of identifying the cytokine and functioning as a tyrosine kinase. No, these molecules identify the cytokine and then, by virtue of interactions intracellularly, modify specific kinases that are referred to as JAK or JAKs. And this stands for Janus activating kinases, and these then phosphorylate specific proteins inside the cell. And the specific proteins are called STATs, which stands for signal transducer and activators of transcription. What do the STATs do? The STATs then dimerize, cross the nuclear membrane, interact with nucleic acid, and modify gene transcription. So these cytokines, you know, are like a mixture mechanistically of an insulin receptor and a steroid receptor, because they both affect phosphorylation and then subsequently affect gene transcription. These are becoming more and more important to us in pharmacology as we make more and more of these molecules for clinical use by recombinant DNA technology. There, I think you have our signaling mechanisms.